Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English stead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I wonder how many boys and girls actually listen to this.
I have often thought zero.
Zero?
I've also often
thought
that.
Is it an approximation or is that a round number?
I believe zero, by definition, is a round number.
It is.
Yes.
As a matter of fact. Well, it's sort of oval.
We should make an office based on the idea of that round number.
Well, an office? A
yeah.
Zero office?
No, an oval office.
An oval office.
Oh!
That's pretty cool.
I'm saying what I believe about politics at the moment. I'm just being beat up by it. Had enough.
Man, am I tired of getting stuff in the... See, I have a post office box in Salado for my personal mail, for our personal mail. And it's one of the smaller post office boxes, and it gets very full this time of year. Normally, it's like
this,
you know,
time of year and this time of
this
the
time
election
of the
cycle.
Season, right? Yeah. We have a long season here.
It's not a hunting season, unfortunately.
By the way, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and as I said earlier, and we're supposed to disclose right here, which is, you know, kind of at least R rated, but we're supposed to, anyway. The Personal Wealth Coach is also an SEC registered investment advisor that has offices in Salado, Texas. It's registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which does not approve or disapprove of these of anything we do or don't do, as the case may be, or therefore.
Yes, they've disavowed everything.
Right. But we do file documents with them, and they are our regulators, so that tells you who to complain to. Complain to the federal government. They're there to help you.
Yes.
Anyway, we had to tell you that. I was going to tell you something else I was going to say.
Were you talking about politics and the post offices? And
yeah, but I totally forgot. Okay, in Salado.
All right.
On May 7th, it's either May 1st or May 7th. I don't remember which. I think it's May 7th. They have the municipal elections.
Uh-huh.
And almost everyone, not almost everyone, all the existing mayor who's running again for mayor, most of the village council, okay?
Right.
Which they call the city council, but it's not a city, it's a village, okay?
And it's alderman, not a council.
Yes, but it's a council.
It's the village alderman.
Okay, the village alderman. The village alderman who are running most of the majority of candidates at the municipal level will not be on the ballot.
So the people running for that office are not going to be...
Yeah, they're not going to be on the ballot. What happened was, apparently...
Somebody got loose with the whiteout?
No, what happened is, apparently you have to... some new regulation... It was a new regulation, and the paper wasn't very clear on this. Or somebody decided to enforce the regulations at the state level.
Okay.
Decided that the form that you fill out to register to run for office... Uh-huh. Everything on there has to be perfect or it's rejected. And they're supposed to notify, by February 7th, they were supposed to notify anyone whose application was rejected because of clerical error or because of typographical error or whatever, and give them another chance. But they didn't notify them until the 23rd, and the 23rd was the deadline to refile. So they didn't get a chance to refile because they didn't get notified until late in the day on the 23rd.
So the ballot doesn't have them
right,
on there. So
right.
You have to write in.
No, they're not even eligible as write-in candidates because you had to also, on the 23rd was the last day you could register as a write-in candidate.
So
nobody knows how this is going to turn out, by the way.
Let's just show up and put colored,
this is gonna be colored one guy,
rocks in a basket.
There's going to be one guy whose name I won't mention.
Because he's got opposition, obviously.
No opposition.
Why would you?
There's one guy who has run many times for mayor,
but
has never been elected mayor, probably for good cause if he was never elected mayor after
know.
Running
we,
all
we
those
don't
times.
Know.
Well, I mean, if he runs several times in a row and anybody who runs against him beats him, that's generally an indication.
Yeah, but not always.
That he's not the most popular guy in the city, in the village.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was based on a fluke.
Right. Well, this.
But. It was an amazing fluke.
I would hesitate to call somebody part of a whale.
I was thinking dolphin.
Oh, okay. Well, they're whales. Anyway, this is the only guy who's going to show up on the ballot.
You think now he's going to get elected for the whole council?
Local politics is pretty fascinating.
Whatever he wants.
It is possible to write in somebody who didn't register as a write-in candidate, I think, and that person is still eligible to win if enough people write in that person's name.
I have written in Mickey Mouse on many elections,
but he's never won.
He's never won.
I've
written in because I think both candidates that I'm voting Mickey Mouse on are Mickey Mouse characters. So,
well, I think the issue is that Mickey Mouse cannot be demonstrated to reside in the area. The geographic area in which
you have to go to the pest control people to figure out if he's been living in the area.
That's
true. It's a very, very large mouse. I'm convinced he lives in the area. He doesn't get cable, but how do we prove that he lives here? Well, there's a big rat's nest over there. It could be a large mouse.
Mm-hmm.
So you could write it in.
Yeah, he probably doesn't have a government issued photo ID.
No, but he might have hanging chads, which are better.
Well,
Mickey Mouse is from Florida, where hanging chads.
No, he is not from Florida. There's a lot of evidence he lives in Southern California. Now he's been seen. He has a second residence in Florida.
So where is he eligible to vote?
Well, he's also been seen a lot in France.
Foreigner.
Yeah, well, he looks like an alien to me. I wonder if he's illegal.
He may have given up his citizenship.
But there's a great deal of evidence that suggests he was born in Southern California. The problem is, when you consider how old he is at this point, whether he is mentally competent to be president.
Or whether he's... are mice even considered mentally competent? Boy, we're going down
a
weird
I think
path.
The National Institutes of Health would agree that mice... With all the experiments they've been doing on mice and how quickly they find their way through
mazes. You're talking about The Secret of NIM.
Yeah, that's true. But
another Disney movie,
I
believe.
It could very well be. Well,
I think you're bringing Disney in a little too often.
You're the one who said Disney.
Disney's the only one that said mice are smart, so you might think that that's not the best source for the information.
So I presume a lot of people watch the reality TV show, this reality
the
TV
debate?
Series. Yes.
I didn't watch it. Couldn't do it. I couldn't handle it. It's too much silliness.
I didn't actually watch it, but I read a report on it, and it said the most telling moment was when the written transcript said unintelligible shouting.
That's what the debates have turned into.
I think it's interesting. It's more like, well, you know, I mean, you got a guy who's a reality TV star.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the dominant force in a debate.
And a couple of senators, which is just as bad.
Well, no, senators are generally pretty boring. Now, they're getting less boring, some of them. But I think it's certainly, the good news is the ratings for the debates since Donald Trump has been the host and moderator have gone up tremendously.
It's become an entertainment. Most of the people that watch the debates aren't showing up to vote.
Well, no, we don't know whether they're going to show up to vote or not, but it'll be interesting to see. Now, Super Tuesday is coming up, and although Super Tuesday runs for several weeks in advance, because it's already going on.
It's kind of like the signs that say happy hour from noon to 6. And
right,
that's
I like
hours.
That.
That's not... So Super Tuesday should be super all these other days, too.
Yeah.
Should
well,
be super on, weeks of...
It's on Tuesday night when they announce the
yes,
results.
Yes, that's the end of it.
That's
okay.
What makes it Super Tuesday. But it'd be really interesting because, very frankly, if Donald Trump wins...
The primary.
The Super Tuesday race, he basically... He won't quite have the nomination completely wrapped up, but the probabilities get really, really high that he will be the Republican candidate. Now,
we've been looking at the polls, and over half, more than 50% of Republicans don't like the guy.
Oh, I thought it was just under 50%, but that could have changed.
Oh, well, yeah, I think it swings back around. So if that's the case, though, if over under half, it doesn't really matter. If only half of the Republicans are going to vote for the guy,
John McCain.
Yeah, is the best case scenario. the Republican Party as a percentage of the country, I don't know if you've been following this, has been shrinking. But so's the Democrat Party. The independents have been getting more and more votes.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to vote for Trump.
Well, I don't know. You never can tell.
When they've been asked in the polls.
In Nevada, though, the independents largely were in the Republican caucuses. Now, what they were doing there, nobody seems to know.
Because by definition, independent means that you don't vote in a primary or a caucus because it's for the party in question.
But it's self-described independents were in the Republican caucuses.
Well, they just decided to vote Republican for the caucus, which means something interesting. It may be that they won't vote that way later.
I will say this is even more entertaining than when Reagan ran against Carter. That was the most entertaining.
I only vaguely remember that.
Well, I remember.
I remember it vaguely because I was very young. I was going to school, and the teacher asked me who I thought the president was going to be, and I looked at her like she was insane because it was Carter. It had been Carter my whole life.
Right.
How could it be anyone other than
Carter?
Well,
not your whole life.
Well, all of my memorable life. Yes. I couldn't remember before Carter was.
The interesting thing was I remember the Republican angst over this guy who was a grade B cowboy movie star.
Right. Ronald Reagan.
Running for president.
Grade B says more about it
he was a TV host for the 20 mule train borax whatever
which I still use.
Yeah, you?
I do. Yeah, I use it as a flux when I'm getting my foundry up to the right.
I've never actually, I don't recall ever actually using a flux, but I'm sure I'm sure there's a good reason for it. Anyway,
I need a capacitor for it, then I'll be on.
This is the personal wealth coaching. We normally talk about things economic, except this is sort of entertaining. Telephone number in here, 773-1400. 254 is the area code. And you're certainly welcome to give us a call and ask any questions, make any comments.
I have something I want to throw in. I mentioned this in the...
Let's be careful that you throw in and not up.
Right. No throwing up. You're just in. Kissinger is on the Council of Foreign Relations. He's...
Go ahead and say his whole name, because a lot of people don't know...
Henry Kissinger.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger,
basically,
who was Secretary of State under
Nixon,
Richard Milhouse Nixon.
So he's since given a lot of advice to Democrats, not Republicans, even though he worked under a Republican president.
Really?
Well, he's on the Council of Foreign Relations. This is giving advice to the administration.
I thought they were nonpartisan.
Well, sort of, but they changed their advice.
Oh,
for the president. So anyway, I'm not a fan of the guy. I don't think he's a horrible, horrible person, but it's pretty close to that. I think that in his own book, he talked about things that he was knowingly lying about during Vietnam. I don't like that. Whether or not we were correct in going to Vietnam was before my time. I look at it as a historical event and as a historical person because he is that old. I look at him in the historical context of lying to the American people, admittedly lying. He admitted to lying to the American people about the reasons for being in the war. And, you know, when people talk about George W. Bush misleading the nation by going into Iraq, I think he was misled himself, misled by information. I don't think he did it intentionally. I think he went to Iraq intentionally. I think he saw it as a real threat. But looking at Kissinger, the guy knew what he was doing and did it anyway. And he's admitted to it. And that makes me sad. But usually it doesn't even come into my thought process because he's kind of a relic from the past, except that he's based this whole report that he and the rest of the council wrote, again, on wrong information. The whole report was written to the president about things that should be done, and to the American people for that matter, on things that should be done for the economy now that China's economy is slowing. Okay. People that have listened to us for very long, and I think my microphone's a little bit low, barely reaching there. People that have been listening to us for very long know that the Chinese economy hasn't slowed. the growth in the Chinese economy has slowed. Two quarters of slowing economy is called a recession. So nobody's suggesting that the Chinese economy is even at the beginning of a recession. They're at a 6.5% growth rate, which is a very fast growth rate if you're talking about a developed country. For a country that's becoming developed, it's slowing down because they're so large. Okay, so people that have listened to us, and now the rest of you who just happen to find this subject fascinating, thinking that might be another oval number. Anyway, people have been listening to me for very long know that Chinese economy is not slowing, and that's the basis for the report. It's the headlines that have come out about it, and he's been quoted as saying it. With the Chinese economy slowing, what do we need to do with our economy and our foreign policy to make up the difference? And
He just left a single word out.
Yeah, the growth in the economy is slowing, which means that the entire plan is wrapped around a concept of, and I've looked at it, it's wrapped around the concept of a massive Chinese recession and them being less active on the world stage and withdrawing from things or being more aggressive in expansion. And you can't really look at both of those as being the same tactic because aggressive expansion, they're building islands, but aggressive expansion historically has been invasions. So anyway, this, it's more of a pet peeve than anything else, but it goes right in hand with the political debates going on. Do the research to know what you're getting upset about before you get upset. That's as simple as I can say this. Many people get upset about a headline without reading the story. Well, in this case, the headline said pretty much what the story said, and it's quoting a guy who by no means is an economist. He's supposed to be an expert in his field, but it's a completely different field, and people are getting upset about a lot of things related to this report, and it just makes me shake my head and go, yes, he's an old man, and he made a major mistake. Maybe the rest of the council wasn't up on economics either, but I think if they're going to use an economic situation as the reason for catastrophe, that they should at least have some economists involved to tell them that's not what's going on. Anyway, yeah. That's my pet peeve. My pet peeve of the day. My feet are clean because I stood on the soapbox for so long.
That's good. Hey, let's talk about the stock market for a second. By the way, today is Saturday, February 27th, 2016. Again, the telephone number is in here, 773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. Hey, market, the S&P 500 is up about 1.5% for the week. Which, you know, in a down market doesn't sound like very much. Let me pat myself on the back here just a little bit. It's going to hurt my shoulder, but I'm going to do it. Back on February 11th, I both wrote and said, this sure looks like the bottom of market. All the indicators are in for a market bottom here, including the fact that Bill Gross says the market is a lot further down to go. And once, you know, when he comes in and says the market is got a lot further to go,
that's usually the bottom.
That generally indicates the bottom.
Bill Gross is the scandal-ridden head of PIMCO who left to go join Janus.
I don't know if he's scandal-ridden.
I think he wrote a scandal.
He did?
Maybe he...
I don't know.
Scandal-wrote?
I don't know of any scandals. Actually, what it is he's...
I know of a scandal.
About him?
Yeah, well,
what?
About the guy that he hired.
What?
From the Yale Endowment, who continued the practice.
Muhammad El Orion?
Yes.
I think he's... Anyway,
folks were not happy.
But Bill Gross is certainly acerbic, and you can look that up, and you can figure out what it means. But
I think most of our
listeners a bond manager,
know what that means.
And he is overwhelmed with his own prophetic ability. I don't particularly care for him because he... says a lot of things, I think, that are very self-serving, and he says them in a pompous and public manner.
Just like us sometimes.
Well, I don't know. We try to be balanced. I don't know that he even tries to be balanced.
Well,
we're
pompous, though, so go ahead.
He's a bond manager, and he wants people to put money in bonds, and he wants people to invest in his bond funds. Cool. And he does that by beating up on stocks. And the funny thing is that the news media, at least in the financial world, continues to ask this guy back again and again and again to comment on the stock market, which is just astonishing to me because the guy is so consistently wrong and nobody calls him on it.
Right. And you're right. You're absolutely right. He is, for all intents and purposes, pretty good at what he does.
I don't know.
His job, if he didn't have a lot of scandal about him, he'd be better. But he's pretty good at bond managing. He's done it a long time, and he's got a pretty good track record. It's been under good circumstances, but he's got a long track record of a good return. Now, having
said all that, wait a minute.
He's asked about stocks, and he's a bond manager.
But during what happened was, during a long period of falling interest rates.
Right. It was under good circumstances.
Under a long period of falling interest rates, when bonds naturally rise.
He did well.
He leveraged the heck out of his funds.
Yeah, which is not safe.
And amplified the returns of those mutual funds, despite the fact they had amazingly high expense ratios and paid out really, really, really impressive commissions to people who sold them. He still had higher returns than anybody else and thereby was thought to be some kind of a genius. It's kind of like...
Interest rates have been flat.
Which I think is really funny because he used to work for PIMCO. And now he's got a bond fund at Janus. Now, the reason I think it's funny is because I've been at this long enough, I really, really well remember the stock bull market in growth stocks of the late 1990s. And Janus was famous for its growth stock funds, Janus 20, Janus Fund, those were all large cap growth funds that bought the highest priced of the most overpriced stocks, and they even went up more, at least partially because a lot of people were putting money into Janus and the S&P 500 index, which shoved the largest stocks, the largest capitalization stocks up. And they became gurus and heroes and were on the cover of Money Magazine again and again and again, which was, from my perspective, the kiss of death. But the issue was they jumped on what was surging, bought more and more and more of it, and were considered to be greater and greater and greater heroes by the media until it all collapsed. And after that, they just kind of disappeared off the map. Well, we had a 30-year period, plus more than 30 years, of falling interest rates. During falling interest rates, bonds rise. So the guy who leverage them, that's multiplies the whatever return they get, either up or down, is going to do the best. And they make him into a hero for doing the best in a bull market by borrowing money to buy something while denying he's borrowing money. But that's neither here nor there. It brings me to another subject, if I may move on to another subject.
Sure.
The other subject is there's a good article in the Wall Street Journal today. And it may have been published yesterday or today. I take it digitally. In the personal finance section about something that the writer hopes will disappear. But I really don't think it's going to go away quite that quickly. And that is what's called revenue sharing in mutual funds. And it's one thing for me to come out and say that there's something there and you should look out for this. And that's obviously self-serving because we don't do that kind of thing. But what the article is about in the Wall Street Journal is that if the Department of Labor manages to go through and actually get its rule published regarding fiduciary responsibility for retirement accounts, that brokers have to be fiduciaries, the revenue sharing may go away. And the reason it may go away is they're going to have to disclose it. One of the things that you may or may not be aware of is that if you're dealing with a retail broker who calls himself typically a financial advisor, they go to conventions each year. They go to these 1 week or longer, or sometimes two of them.
Sometimes they call them conferences.
They call them conferences or conventions, and they're generally in a five-star resort someplace, and they get to take the companion of their choice with them. And it's all expense paid, and they live really, really, really high on the hog during that period. Well, somebody pays for that. And who pays for that is the people who buy the investment products that are called preferred partners or partners or emerging partners or whatever with the broker-dealer. And these partner funds and these partner fund families pay sometimes more to the broker-dealer than the total commissions that you're seeing. And they do that with a very, very, it's buried deep in the fine print of the prospectus. It's very deep, deep, deep down. If you have to page down about 20 times and then go to another site with a link to read about it at the broker-dealer. But that is your money they're using to do that with, but they don't tell you about it. And you can pretty well depend on the fact that they want to go to these things and they want to get these awards and they get points for selling, even if they call themselves acting as an investment advisor, they get points for choosing. They actually get this revenue sharing even when they're supposedly acting as an investment advisor. Well, the DOL rule will effectively forbid that for IRAs, which should hopefully, maybe, conceivably make it go away. Actually, they can still do it. They just have to disclose it. And if I know Wall Street, they'll find some way to disclose it in such a way that it sounds like a beautiful thing they're doing for you and a wonderful favor they've done for you by taking some money out of your fund so that the guy who is recommending it to you, or girl or female or male or whatever, can get to go to a five-star resort for a couple of weeks with the companion of their choice. This is.
But tell us what you really think about that. I mean, don't hold back.
I don't. I think it's underhanded, duplicitous, and dishonest.
Okay.
But it has technically been legal up till now, and that is the story. If there's ever a story on Wall Street, is it right there?
Yeah.
They do dishonest things.
It sounds to me a lot like the relationship that Boeing had in the 1980s with the Department of Defense. Where the defense people, the generals and so on, would show up, the ones that make the decisions about who spends what money where after they get the money from Congress, and were wined and dined and given the most fabulous treatment in the world. And when the American public heard about it, they said, that's not appropriate, and not in quite that volume or those words, generally much higher and with more things you're not allowed to say on the radio. Well, we feel the same way about a big chunk of what's going on, not just in Wall Street, but in how the whole world of finance is run on the backs of the investors rather than for the benefit of the investors. There it is.
Yeah, well, in the article, which is, by the way, Money Beat, is that the name of it? Money Beat, The Intelligent Investor by Jason Zweig. February 26th, and it's in the Wall Street Journal, so finally somebody has said something about it. So what happens is this revenue, let's see if we can get the numbers. He's got the numbers in here. $153 million to Edward Jones last year.
To do really
in revenue sharing.
In revenue sharing.
That's not commissions. That's not
revenue,
the...
Yeah, $153 million is for the conferences, basically. That's what they spend on whining and dining. It's technically supposed to be used, revenue sharing, for marketing.
Well, this is what it says here. The financial industry calls these fees payment for shelf space, and they can add up. At Edward Jones, revenue sharing fees from fund companies topped $153 million in 2014.
Okay, wait just a second. Shelf space. Think about that for a second in an electronic world. Okay, now go ahead.
Or just under 20% of the total net revenue to the company, to Edward Jones last year, came from undisclosed. Well, they're technically disclosed.
They're in the fine print of the prospectus.
That's
right.
You
can find it in there.
Merrill Lynch did a little better. They only made let's see, $750,000 per year from each of 28 fund companies it had designated as global partners.
How many million?
$750,000 per year.
Okay.
Per company.
Per company.
Times 28 companies.
Wow.
And $350,000 a year from 11 emerging partners. You can add up 28 times 750,000 plus 11 times 350,000 to figure out how much money Merrill Lynch got in 2014. this is one of those things that you may think, well, okay, so the company's getting paid, and I get statements from them, and they keep up with my stuff, and that's really cool.
So is it 11, or is it 28 times?
28 companies times 750,000.
Okay.
Plus 11 companies times 350,000. You're going to add all that up. That's cool. Anyway, it's one of those things that is...
Well, the first number is 21 million.
Okay, 21 million.
Plus 11 times 350?
28 times 750,000 is more than 11 million.
I said 21 million.
Okay.
11 times 350,000.
Yeah, 21 million.
So I'm going to add it all up.
It's only like $50 million or something, right?
Well, it's less than that.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, that's not as much as...
It's $24,850,000 a year.
Okay.
That's not huge.
But that's not as much as Edward Jones got.
No, $25 million. I mean, that's not a lot of money.
Edward Jones got $153
million. That's more money, but they're still... We're talking about revenue sharing here.
20% of their revenue comes from something that you don't see unless you read the prospectus carefully prior to investing.
Well, I mean, it's shelf space. You know the shelf space in the brokerage office is very limited.
Wait a minute. The shelf space is at the convention.
Exactly.
What happens is when the broker financial advisor gets to the convention or the conference or whatever, they have continuing education that they're mandated to receive.
Yes.
And guess who gives the classes on for the continuing education?
The people that give the biggest donations.
The people who paid for the shelf space. And, of course, in no way are they going to give this objective education in a way that would make people think that their funds were a better fund.
No, of course not. That would be immoral. And in fact, we grew up in the brokerage world, the two of us, and I more than you, in that you had a prior career, and I was literally growing up around the brokerage world. It is an amazing feeling because brokers actually do a very good service to the public. So don't get us wrong there. Brokers provide the ability for people to get to the market. Now, with online places popping up, what they're really needing to be providing to people is education on how to invest rather than being in the act of doing it anymore.
Well, let me tell you where some of that other money goes. It doesn't pay for the conventions.
Oh, what's that?
There's a lot of people in Congress who are very, very seriously opposed to a fiduciary standard for brokers, for financial advisors. The financial advisors actually have to act
in the best interest of the client. Yeah,
for IRAs and retirement accounts only. That's only. They're very much against it. They've done everything possible to be against it. And if you look at who's contributing to their campaign funds or whatever else, who gives the money, you'd understand why they're so against it. And basically, you are paying for your representative, who, by the way, is vigorously against anything that looks like fiduciary to be imposed, even though there's a law passed by a Republican Congress and a Republican president that mandates the Department of Labor set up a fiduciary standard.
It's called the Pension Protection Act of 2006.
And it's taken from 2006 till now for the DOL to write the rules because Congress keeps rejecting them.
Congress has rejected them because money from these sources is going...
So basically, if you're...
To lobbies.
If you're using one of these financial advisors and they're putting you in one of their partner funds, which they probably are, then you are paying your congressman to ensure that your financial advisor does not act in your best interest.
Wow.
That's the nutshell. And I know that's going to make some people angry if they happen to love their Edward Jones broker, if there's any Edward Jones brokers who are listening to this.
And we can come right out and say Edward Jones, by its nature, is not an evil place.
No.
It's a good place. It's provided a great deal of service to the rest of the world.
I'm,
there are some problems with the way finances are run back and forth, and it's based on an older model that the only way that investment could happen was through a major brokerage house.
Actually, it's not based on an older model. It's based on a newer model. The old model was they charged
even
you
worse.
No. The old model was they charged you a commission. You saw it on the statement, which they don't do anymore.
Right. They stopped that a long time ago.
You saw the commission. You saw what you were being charged, and you understood what you were paying for something. There was a series of, actually I hate to say this, but it was under Reagan, where a series of bills went through Congress, president signed into law.
This is confusing to the American people.
That allowed them to hide money they were getting from investment products and disguised it as distribution fees and marketing fees. And
the
and
value that if in a mutual fund, the price of the mutual fund as quoted is quoted as net asset value. And yet what people were buying was a price higher than that.
Because, they still are.
And they still are. And that price higher than that is the commission going to the broker.
And even that division between those two prices doesn't account for all the money. And I'm just in favor of one thing, and that is if you're going to go to, quote, financial advisor, end quote, that financial advisor should be upfront and say, this is how much you're being charged to buy this security.
Right.
And this is how much you're going to pay a year to buy this security. And that's your money that's paying me, that's paying the brokerage house, that's paying the congressman.
If you're still okay with that, that's great.
And it's also paying for my all-expense-paid 5-star vacation.
Right.
And if you're okay with that.
And you can be. If you really like your broker and they tell you about it, it's all good.
Of course,
it's when it's not being explained like that. When you don't have the choice that I don't like.
There is another issue, which is one of the reasons the brokerage houses hate this new law or this new rule. And that is that all that under the table money.
It's not really under this table. It's disclosed.
You can look under the table and see it, but you have to look under the table.
Mm-hmm.
So it's under the table.
It's totally legal.
Yeah.
Just not
all of
ethical.
That is tax-free. In other words, the broker does not get a 1099 that says we spent $25,000 you to a 5-star resort for a week.
They're changing that.
As far as I know, it's still a tax-deductible marketing
expense.
We
do get 1099s for weird things now.
As
in meals. You know, we've sat with people and gotten meals and gotten 1099s.
No, I'm saying that we have?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, what I'm saying is that the going to a qualifying resort, and there are certain countries that are qualifying resorts, does not result in a 1099 going back to the broker or the financial advisor. The person just gets an all-expense-paid tax-free vacation, and they get it at your expense. And it's one of those things that, again, I don't mind them getting that. I don't mind them getting that at all. What I do mind is that they don't disclose it when you're buying. They don't disclose it when they're advising you to take this fund over that fund, even though you're technically not paying a commission. It's one of those things that will hopefully go away with the DOL's new rules, presuming that the Republicans in the House continue to be unsuccessful in blocking it. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. We've got to do some commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and our telephone number remains 254-773-1400, and we got a break for commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more from the Personal Wealth Coach.
Illegal.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I hope you'll forgive me for my rant against negativity. My negative rant against
negative
negativity.
Rants against, yeah. I'm so anti-negativity. But I just disappeared. I became a double negative.
Telephone numbers in here, 254-773-1400. Hey, we had an upgrade made to the system.
To the whole economy.
Yes. The fourth quarter GDP was upgraded from 0.7 to 1%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but actually it is.
It's a 0.3% upgrade to the economy. That amounts to a lot of money.
Yeah, I'd say, well, you could if you really want to have been sensationalist about it, you could say GDP increased by 30%.
Except that's not really true.
It's actually a little more than 30%.
Yeah.
It's actually like 40%.
Yeah, it's like upgraded by.
But from 0.7 to 1 is
35%.
Like a 35%.
Well, it's a 50%.
It's a 35% upgrade.
Yeah.
About a 35% upgrade. So you Commerce Department upgrades GDP estimate for fourth quarter by 35%. That's really impressive, you know? We went from 0.7 to 1. That's not the end of the story, though. The rest of the story is that when you look at what was going on, almost all of it is the kind of stuff that indicates a healthy economy. And it indicates that a lot of the negatives weren't as bad. We imported less than they thought we did. Inventory drawdown was less than they thought. You go down through the pieces of it, and what you find is that we are in a really relatively healthy economy, and the economy is still growing nicely. Jobs are up, wages are rising. The only negative to it, and it's the tiniest little bit of negative, is that official year-over-year inflation, if you take out the falling price of gasoline, has risen to a whopping 1.3%. Now, if you plug in the falling price of gasoline over the last year, it's nothing, no inflation. But the markets on Friday, when they got this information, initially said, ooh, that's really good. The economy's doing better. And they said, oh, wait a minute.
It's bad. That means the Federal Reserve might actually continue to do what they've already said they were going to do.
That's bad. So we go down. But, again, the good news is that since we basically have recovered in the stock markets about half the losses that occurred so far this year. Now, that's nothing to get too terribly excited about, obviously.
Yeah, so if you go to Vegas and you come back and you say, I've recovered half of my losses, people aren't as impressed.
No, it's not.
This isn't Vegas, but it's not.
We may talk about
either.
This some more, but the other thing is that short interest is at a five-year high. Now, that obviously doesn't make any sense to much of
anybody. That's just not a very PC way of saying it. I mean, what are you talking about? Short?
What that means is
tight challenge.
The percentage of total volume on the New York Stock Exchange that is sales where people have sold stock they don't own.
Right. So they have to buy the stock so that they can own it and sell it, which they've already done.
They have to buy it back at some point. Because they pay interest on the short sale until they buy the stock back.
They actually borrowed the stock from someone, sold the stock to someone else. They now have to buy that stock. They're hoping the price drops. But if it doesn't drop, they still have to buy it back.
So what we've got is the maximum pessimism in 5 years on the stock exchange. Now, if you go back 5 years, you realize it's the last time it was this bad was in 2011. And that was during the previous correction, which the stock market went on to eclipse very nicely on the upside. Now, the good news is about that. That's why record short interest or over a five-year period or thereabouts is good news, is at some point, the equivalent of 20% of the daily volume of the New York Stock Exchange has got to be bought. And the clock is ticking when these short sellers have to go in and buy a whole bunch of stock. Now
they don't
causes...
like that because as they're buying it, the price of the stock is going up, and the next short seller goes, "Oh no, I better buy it now before it goes up very much further because I don't want to be left holding the bag." Mm-hmm. And that's the way these things go.
And that causes a upward panic.
Yes, panicked upward swing of the market.
And it's going to come. It's one of those things that when you see, if you're an observer of the market and you see a great deal of short interest in the market, you know,
it may not
happen
a lot all
of people once. Who could lose a lot of money if the market goes up. And what'll happen typically is if the market starts to rise, which it has over the last 2 weeks, they will reach a point when their confidence breaks and they all rush in to buy at the same time. And when they do, the people who don't even realize what's going on, it's very much like when the market turns down. We'll look out there and say, obviously a lot of people know something I don't know about economy on the market, so we better, quote, jump in there and buy. And what typically occurs is somewhere along here, and it will at this point obviously be some point in March, we will get a sudden, and
blip.
I don't know this for sure, but I strongly suspect we will see a sudden rush back into the market at some point in March. And the market will rise very substantially. It could be as quickly as this Friday, because we got a jobs report coming out on Friday, and Lord knows how to read these things, because basically if we get a lot of employment, we get a lot of new jobs, and the economy is really, really healthy,
people might be afraid
the Fed might raise interest rates towards a net zero.
They've already said they're doing that, though. The Fed has actually already said they're raising those rates. So people are panicking over whether the Fed raids the rates when it's known already. It's going to happen.
And actually, one of the strangest things is the headline in the Wall Street Journal. Stocks rise for one day there. Actually, was it the Wall Street Journal? Make sure I'm quoting correctly. Yes, the Trader. Stocks jump 1.5% on stronger economic data. Except on Friday, stocks fell a little bit on stronger economic data.
Of course they did.
That
we're about out of time.
Perfectly good sense.
We'll
anyway.
Talk about more about the irrationality of the market next hour. It's a very rational long-term thing, but a very irrational short-term place to be. So
some good news in home buying, too, that we're going to talk about
right.
next hour. But
yeah,
if you would
stuff.
Like to contact us off the air, we have a couple of telephone numbers that you can use. We have voicemail on the weekends, obviously. During the week, we have live people answer the phone. You don't get a phone tree, so get ready to talk to somebody. And locally, it's, of course, 254 area code, and it is 94. It's a hard one to remember, 947-1111.
You can contact us off the air as well through email, or on the air for that matter. We'll be checking the email while we're on here at Jafe. Excuse me, putting our words together here. Both of our names in the same word, Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. That's tpwc.com. You can listen to more of us fubbing our own names at podcasts that we have there. We also have a list of our philosophy and how to contact us. So until next hour, where we have lots of good stuff to talk about, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News.